You are listening to the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. Find me on Twitter at NJH287, also on LinkedIn, where I post more content, the website, dsmsports.net, where you can find every episode, and of course, subscribe, follow the podcast on whichever podcast platform is your favorite. An awesome show for you guys today. Great timing as the Formula One season is in high gear. Depending on when listening to this, the Miami Grand Prix will have just gone off fairly recently. My guest on the podcast today is Nirupam Singh. He is all over motorsports. He is a ghostwriting agency founder. He's also a creative strategic consultant for tech companies, particularly in the sports space, as well as just motorsports in general. He's also the author of the Motorsport A&R newsletter. You can subscribe to that. And he's also just someone that you'll frequently see on LinkedIn providing great insight and content in the overall sports space and beyond. And particularly, again, motorsports is what we'll focus on in today's interview. Just a really interesting interview to come. We really dive into the fan development and fan growth in the motorsports space with a specific focus on Formula One. Obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are aware of Drive to Survive and how that just completely transformed the industry. But there was stuff happening before that even when Liberty Media took over and greater access and greater content and greater focus on the importance of social media, the importance of content really came into the fold. And you're seeing all these new fans come in, all these new different types of fans as well. Just a tremendous conversation. So here he is, Nirupam, also known as Niru Singh, talking all about motorsports with me. Back with today's guest, and I'm so psyched to pick his brain. We've been having a good chat already offline. Now we're getting joined today on the podcast by Nirupam Singh. You may also know him as Niru. He is a ghostwriting agency founder, doing some great work in that space. Has been in the sports space for years now, in motorsports as well as other sports technology. He is a wealth of knowledge, and we're going to learn a lot from him today. And before I keep going, welcome to the podcast today, Niru.
Hey, thanks, Neil. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
So psyched to learn from you. You really get the space, and you're really good at talking about it too, and are able to explain things in clear detail. So before we get into the meat of our discussion, though, tell us about you. Tell us about your career path, your experience along the way, what you're doing today, and any tips for folks that want to try to do what you do.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there to cover within 10 years, and I appreciate that intro there. The best way I really have described myself in the last 10 years is through video content, photo content, partnerships, and you know, navigating my own space and skill stacking along the way, from video, photo, partnerships, learning marketing, learning how to write properly, how to speak to clients. There's a wealth of knowledge that I've gained over the past 10 years to be able to kickstart my agency now. And a lot of that focus has been around motorsports, but there's obviously, if you're into motorsports, you kind of have an interest in other sports as well. So there's been a lot of journey across, you know, those 10 years where I'm like, wow, I've learned a lot. So why don't I just apply a lot more, implement it with the people that I love speaking to all the time.
Yeah. And I guess like what led to the decision to start an agency versus like, I want to go find a team to work for, a league to work for? Because you really do have, as you mentioned, you have this diverse skill set, understanding of the sports space, of what organizations are looking for. And that's obviously going to be a big part of what's serving you and your agency is having the understanding of what people need and what the pain points are. So what kind of led to that decision of, I'm going to do my own thing, because it's super admirable?
Short answer, there was no other option. I kind of had my back against the wall there for the last 2 years. So a bit of context, I was working in the UK for a F1 contractor, and you know, things didn't go out the way that I was hoping for. It was a dream job of mine at the time, but you know, it ended sourly, but that was completely fine. And I was back in Canada, spent the next 2 years basically looking for a job within motorsports or sports, and couldn't find anything. So I really had to kickstart my agency and started writing on LinkedIn a lot more, and figured this is the best way to go about expanding my growth, working for myself, and expanding my network of people. So really, it started from a place of desperation, if you could say, but it has worked out. So I'm going to continue sticking with it.
Oh yeah, no, I want to double click on a few things there. First, let's go back to the background a little bit of, you know, what was your dream job growing up? How'd you develop a passion for sports and ultimately the business of sports? And you know, how that lead into your career choice?
Yeah, I mean, my journey for being passionate about sports started from motorsports. So it's been a part of my entire life. As a kid, I've been around it for forever. and it's been inseparable. So whether it was cars, fast cars, automotive, I was always around fast cars and people that had nice cars. And so it was in just the nature of the space. And growing up in the Middle East as well, that there was a level of proximity to it that you can't just take me away from it. So, when I moved out to Canada, there was an even more emphasis towards that and making sure that I'm involved in that space somehow. So, and I'm sure we'll discuss it down the road of how that happened, but really it was starting out as a kid, and then it's bled into many other sectors of work.
Yeah, and as you've learned more about just the overall sports industries, across sports, like, do you find that are there similar issues and problems and opportunities, or are there so much disparities across different types of sports, different organizations, different leagues? Some are more mature than others in some places, and some are less mature than others in other places. Or like, how much similarities are there in through lines, and how much really do you have to hone in on this individual sport, or this individual demographic, or this country, or whatever it might be?
Yeah, each league and series is going to have their own differences, obviously. And from what I've noticed through the perspective of motorsport is motorsport has always kind of lacked in terms of pushing the boundaries in marketing and always been that one step behind. When I compare that to the NBA or the NFL, I look at them as leaders in the space and how to look at what's going to be the next big thing that's going to happen, and looking at them as forefronts of how do we push forward our narrative, and how do we make sure we maximize our revenue within the league. So naturally, each league and series is going to have one. Some are going to be at the very top, some are going to be very low, and each one has its own challenges. But the one common denominator I always see is everyone's on this hamster wheel. You have this in the corporate world, especially in the US, and it's more prevalent in sports, is everyone is on this level of hamster wheel, like going back to back to back to back weekends, whether it's with the NBA, the NFL, or with motorsports. Every person within the team is running on fumes, essentially. So, they're most of the time they're either overworked or they have a lot going on. So a lot of challenges are stemmed from that. Nate, from the nature of just being so fast-paced.
Yeah. Let's actually dive in a little bit to like how did you become a motorsports fan, and is that the same way that most people become motorsports fans today? And when you think of motorsports, you think of NASCAR versus MotoGP versus Grand Prix versus F1. Like, is it easy to cross over, or are there, like, I mean, you see right now in the States, like, are there some people that are like, I'm not an F1 fan, I'm a NASCAR fan, or vice versa?
Yeah, but it's motorsport under the umbrella of motorsport. There's a lot of different leagues and series. When I explain that to someone that doesn't know anything about it, and their assumption is to always go to NASCAR, or at least before Drive to Survive, that was the go-to answer, is, oh, I know about NASCAR, I don't know about F1. And the more you dig deeper into it, you have your top three: IndyCar, Formula One, and MotoGP. But underneath that, there's a lot more that people haven't dug into. So, yeah, under the umbrella, there's a lot more. And my introduction as a fan was just going to the Bahrain Grand Prix as a kid in 2004. So that was my first introduction. My dad took me to that race, and I was hooked since then. So there was, like I mentioned, there was no taking me back away from it. I was hooked since that first moment. And now new fans are coming through Drive to Survive. Obviously, that's been a huge discourse over since that TV series has launched. I'm finding more fans to be that case rather than fans that kind of grew up like me, where they were just introduced to it by family members. But either way works. There's no gatekeeping from my end of, you should be this type of fan. If you're not a fan, if you haven't come through this way. So yeah, well, all new fans are welcome.
I know, hell yeah. We'll definitely talk about Drive to Survive. Before we get into that, though, I guess, what did the pre-Drive to Survive, like, fan journey look like? I mean, you talk about yourself and your own experience. I know from going to a NASCAR race, the first NASCAR race I went to, I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. Like, once you go in person, it's like, it's so different than what you're watching on television. So, like, what did those fan types of fans and those fan journeys look like? in the pre-job survive days, I guess, and whether it was you or your peers or your friends or people you grew up with, or what you just saw being kind of in the space.
Yeah, this is taking it back from all the way to like, well, taking it back till 2016 really is when I started to see a bit of a shift towards that pre Drive to Survive. What it kind of looked like, and I want to explain this tangibly, was I would be in high school and I would have one corner of the table with me and my one friend that talked about racing in F1 because we were the only two people in our high school from all four generations. I mean, maybe there might have been more, but there was only one person I spoke to about F1, and that got it. And then transferring that to university, I remember in 2015 being at a residence with some of my friends, and we were just taking a break. I was watching some F1 highlights from 2004, 2005, trying to reminisce on these moments, and everyone else was asking me, "What the heck are you watching? And why are you watching this? And it doesn't make any sense. And put your phone away." To now, those exact friends that have told me, "What are you watching?" are avid Ferrari fans or Mercedes fans, and there's been a complete shift in their perspective on how they view fans, how they view F1, how they view motorsports, and they're going to races. They're actively participating in the conversation. They know what's happening in the details of the drivers. So tangibly, that's what it looks like, is that shift from having that one friend to me now speaking to every single person at the gas station when I stop. I'm wearing a Mercedes hat and they want to talk about F1. And that's what it feels like in real life, is you're being surrounded by it all the time. And I love that.
Well, I mean, in that community aspect and that water cooler chatter, for lack of a better term, certainly, adds to it and makes that snowball effect really come into play, I guess. But let's go into that. With Drive to Survive, you have this influx of new fans that may become fans because they really like whatever the rivalry between two drivers on a team, or they really like the personality of Daniel Ricciardo, or whatever it might be. You have these, I guess, fans that came up not because they went to a race and saw really fast cars and were like, this is cool, or not because they care about the engine development strategy of Mercedes or Ferrari or whatever it might be. So like, how does that different fan demographic, I guess first off, what was your view as seeing that massive shift when Liberty Media took over and when Drive to Survive became a thing, and that level of access, and how did you see that sort of play out? Like, I guess what was holding it back before that, and how quickly did you see those results once Liberty Media came in and said, "Hey guys, we need to do this another way. We're gonna fall behind it, and not really capture this next generation of fans."
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There's a lot of touch points to talk about there. It happened very slowly because, from what I recall, Liberty Media came in 2014, around 2014, I believe. And in
I guess
2014,
at the stage, I guess before Liberty Media, when it was what Bernie Ecclesiastes, however you pronounce the name, like
yeah.
F1 was not too good with access, right?
No, not at all, to be honest. And even honestly, pre 2014 and during Bernie's era, there's a lot of restriction as to what, at least from the paddock, from what I was seeing, because I wasn't involved at that stage as a professional, is the level of access people were getting. So, to be honest, there was a level of mystique around it. It's like, what is this secretive, exclusive thing?
Yeah, what's going on
And
inside there?
to a large extent, obviously that worked, but as TV rights came in, as social media came in, that no longer applied to that business model. So Liberty Media came in and saw, right, NBA and the NFL are doing bits. Why don't we look at this amazing property, which was amazing at the time, but it lacked a lot of access. It lacked a lot of it wasn't speaking the same language as the fans. And who knows what would have happened, hypothetically speaking, if Liberty hadn't come in and Bernie kept running the show. Would he have been phased out, or would the sport have died? These are all hypotheticals, but there was a level of access, definitely for sure, that wasn't permitted And perhaps that led all the way down to the fans that were watching the races and wanted to keep up with it all the time.
Yeah, and then once that shift happened, like how do you start to see that the I guess the composition of the fan base start to change? Like, was it sort of like, I guess you probably saw it in the content as well. Like, maybe there was content that was more, let's do interviews about whatever the favorite foods these guys have or what they think of Game of Thrones. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here versus, more into the stuff that the more, I guess, motorheads, gearheads, whatever term you want to use. I don't know what the proper terminology is.
Yeah.
Like, with that shift in fan demographics and interest, like, how do you see the content that the league and the teams and what the fan demand was for that kind of content? How did that kind of evolve as the fan base evolved?
Yeah, I think people have there's a bias around because we're seeing it now so often and it's flooded in our feeds, but that didn't happen very quickly. Even when Draft to Survive came out, that didn't happen very quickly. So I won't. There's a great creator named Toni Cohen Brown, and she's spoken on length about this. And she's mentioned that Draft to Survive obviously came in and did its work and exposed a lot of that to new fans. And the demographics changed from 50 plus to more younger fan base, which is what it intended to do, but. What really kickstarted a lot of this content creation and testing out new formats was around 2020 when we had no time, when we had basically free time essentially to do whatever we wanted to do, and we had time to think. And that gave a lot of content creators and new people that wanted to binge that show the perfect opportunity to speak about a new topic that they had no clue about, but they were interested by, and they went and created new content around it on TikTok, Instagram, all these platforms. So she's spoken about on length about this, and it was a number of sequences of events, of almost accidental events that happened, which has led us to this stage. And now that F1 obviously sees what NBA and the NFL are doing, a lot of that stuff is going to be then copied over and translated to what motorsport is, what we can do in motorsport. So the teams will look at it, the social media admins will look at it, and they're going to try and replicate something similar. So the shift has happened across many, many years. It ha didn't happen instantly.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting insight for sure. And I think you look at like the more, I guess, traditional stick and ball sports where you have these generational, I guess, dedication or like loves for a given team, and you're cheering for laundry, so to speak. And you cheer for if a new player joins your team, you cheer for that player now. Maybe and I guess on the F1 side or NASCAR side even, maybe not quite as much for their shifting teams. But like, if you are running an F1 team, running any sort of motorsports team, are you looking at, we're trying to make fans fall in love with these individual drivers, even though Lewis Hamilton could leave next year and go to another team? So like, how do you balance that? We want them to fall in love with these athletes that represent our team, especially now with social media being so, people driven and individual driven, and Rob's only added to that and made that even stronger. Versus, I want someone to root for whatever, Haas Racing, no matter who's on our team, as the rosters change and drivers come and go. Like, how do you think about reconciling that from a content perspective, and how do teams look at that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Teams, for the most part, are, like I mentioned, on the cycle of going to race after race after race after race. And when that translates over to content, there are specific needs, obviously, from the teams and their sponsors that they need to adhere to. So one of the objectives, obviously, will be to make sure the drivers are seen in a positive light and they're shown in a way where the fans can relate to them. So, but those are one of many objectives that they're looking at. And to be fair, and to be honest, it's an easier task because it's not like they have to go out and do that marketing on its own. If you take, for example, Ferrari doesn't need to go out and convince people to go buy it. People come in and buy those cars because they want it. So in the same aspect, these drivers are seen as superheroes and they're seen as likable personalities through their own social media. And You don't have to really put a don't necessarily have to put an amazing frame around these drivers because they're liked and likable anyways, and they're gonna get the following no matter what. It's the team's job, obviously, there to accelerate that further, and there are ways they're going about doing that. But those are all like very minor details to the overall bigger picture of what the team is trying to do. Essentially, they want to keep the sponsors happy, and they want to continue winning. They want to hopefully win races and get more money to go and race, essentially.
It's almost like you have a machine that, yes, we might be building up Lewis Hamilton and adding so much, cachet to his brand, and he might leave next year, but our machine will take whoever comes in next is going to be just as big, or at least we think he's going to be just as big as Lewis Hamilton, and they'll be a superstar next. And like you kind of churn them out that way, so that I mean, granted too, the drivers have sometimes have bigger brands than the teams themselves, of course, in many ways. So like, is it almost agnostic where whoever's going to fill the seat next is going to be a superstar just as much as the last guy because of what we can do, what our brand says, and all that? Like, instead of trying to.
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think going back on that topic, I think it's every driver will have a different level of, in terms of the marketability, a different level of difficulty. Obviously, if you have someone like Lewis, it's going to be very easy to market him, and people are just going to eat up everything that he either speaks or talks about, because he's bigger than the sport, and no matter what anyone says, he's larger than the sport, to be honest. He's transcended culture, or transcended the sport, and is basically mainstream in culture. Your lowest end driver is not going to have that same level of reputation. People will know them, but they're more niche in the market. So again, going back to it, it's yeah, the team's one of their objectives obviously will be to amplify their drivers, but if you look at the overall team picture, it's they want to go win races, and a lot of these drivers tend to be either paid drivers or people or drivers that might not have the same level of skill or marketability as them, so they might need to do a bit more work. So it's different challenges for different situations.
How do you think the sponsors look at it? Like, is the sponsor going to be like, we want to work with Max Verstappen because he wins every race, even if he's not like the biggest personality compared to some others in the sport? Not that he's devoid of personality, but like versus Daniel Ricciardo might not win any races at all, or not near as many podiums as Max Verstappen, that's for damn sure. But he is so charismatic and personable and will do better in our ads and sponsor activations. Like, how do you look at, is it basically, is it performance all day, every day, or is it sometimes looking at who's gonna, move the needle more on social media in some ways, and then with their personal accounts or just content that they're featured in?
Yeah, so team sponsorships and driver sponsorships are a bit different. So you have someone like, for example, Fernando Alonso, who has since joining TikTok, and props to Aston Martin and their team, to on their social media team on this, because they do a very, very good job of understanding who their audience is and catering to their needs. So the guy, their social media manager or content creator, Jimmy, is very good at understanding how to build Fernando Alonso into this charismatic personality. So again, going back to it, it's different challenges for different personalities and different drivers. And sponsors, I guess it really depends on which sponsor you're talking about. Some of the sponsors like MSC Cruises or Rolex will go and just do massive title partnerships with F1. They don't see the value of perhaps going to a single individual driver. And this conversation kind of leads more into as well on who can create the more depth with their audience versus just overall reach. So yes, Max, if you look at the example of Max and Daniel, Max is someone that's winning races right now, and all the eyeballs are basically on him. So naturally, every single sponsor would naturally want to go to him and go, oh, he's the most, he's getting the most eyeballs. Let's go to him, and hopefully we can generate more interest for our brand. But is it necessarily going to drive more results to their brand and to their products and services? Maybe not, because he just cares about racing. Whereas Daniel will truly understand, even though he's not winning races, he still has a great level of reach but he can have a deeper level of impact because he has this ability to just charm people through his social, through his ideas and the way he speaks to his fans more clearly. So,
Yeah.
you know, this goes back to if what the sponsor is looking for and whether they're looking for reach or they're looking for impact. So that's really the question to ask more for the sponsors rather than for the drivers.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. You almost have to separate, like, there's a most talented or most accomplished athlete, and then there's the most marketable, and it's not always one and the same. Like, I mean, I think you look at Major League Baseball in the United States, for years, everyone was like, Mike Trout, why isn't he more marketable? Even though he was the best player in the game every single year, and yet, these other athletes were moving the needle more, or, were more marketable for athletes, for sponsors to work with. It's a super interesting thing to think about. Let's talk briefly about just the type of fan that motorsports in general, whether it's F1 or otherwise, should be going after. Like, is the fan that is coming in through Drive to Survive more fickle or more likely to lapse if they get bored or whatever, versus one that, like, should we want them to become fans of the sport versus fans of the content, the story, as opposed to, like, again, the fan that really wants to know, like, what kind of tires they're going on today's track, or what the conditions are like. Like, is the goal, once you get that fan in, to get them to become avid fans of the sport and get them to really, be able to talk about it intelligently? Or at the end of the day, like, yes, the fan that comes in through Drive to Survive and is just there for the, for the drama, is that fan just as likely to stick around for years?
Yeah, that's a good question. So right off the bat, there is no judgment as to where people find what
No
they
doubt.
enjoy and how they become fans. So whether you're a fan of the engineering, you're a fan of the driver's personality, or you came to Drive to Survive, there's something about the sport that captivated you that made you interested. For me, it was the natural raw speed of these machines, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. Everyone comes in through their own ways, and that's the beauty of it, is that if everyone came through just one channel, everyone would just talk about similar things. So it covers a lot of different sectors. So that's the most amazing part, and I always try and keep that open mind of there's many different types of fans that enjoy the sport in many different ways. The second point is, okay, now they're in. Let's just strip it back to the basic. It's like we got the fans. How do we keep them over a longer period of time? And this is where the problem I think arises, is in the marketing and in the way the sponsors also handle this. Because now everyone is seeing this amazing sport, and the sport has a lot of reach and level of success that every single sponsor and everyone involved wants to capitalize on it. But that's the problem. They want to capitalize on it, not maintain it. So as soon as they got the fan, now all bets are off, and it goes, okay, we made as much money from you as possible. It's kind of like bye. And that's what I want to really avoid, is how can we maintain and keep these fans over a longer period of time? Because you don't just become a fan by watching one thing. You become a fan over seeing it multiple times. And then you start finding like-minded people. So there needs to be better strategies and better systems in place to nurture these fans over a longer period of time. These fans, if you talk about demographics, are much younger now. The fan base of the age has shifted from being 50 plus to much lower. 18 to 35 is I think the number. And so these fans are going to grow up with the sport over a longer period of time. So how can we maintain that so that as these fans grow up, they can pass down this passion of theirs to their kids and to their peers?
Yeah.
Because word of mouth at the end of the day is the most powerful way of marketing and the best way to sell something. So, you know, if we can figure out ways to keep these fans and maintain these fans over a longer period of time, we can assure that we can continue to attract newer fans down the road.
Yeah, you build these communities, and that fans feel like they're part of something bigger than themselves, and they have more than just that one person at the corner of your lunch table to be able to talk about the sport with.
Exactly.
But it's a really interesting case study because, I mean, we haven't really had precedent for this kind of thing where we have so many fans come in because they watch a show. And it's almost like You could have fans like I'd be curious to know what percentage of fans watching Drive to Survive like any given season, if they watch like the most recent season of Drive to Survive, if they know the results in advance, or if they are like it's almost like they're are they fans of the TV show or are they the fans of the sport? Like in which case are they not? In which case they don't know what's happening, and they only experience the sport through this show. And for all they know, the show could just be a Hollywood show, just like any other sitcom almost, or drama. And it's really like, how do you make sure that those are, and is it okay for those fans to exist as long as they still follow on social and engage in other ways? If they don't actually care about who wins and loses in real time, they don't spoil it for me. I haven't watched the season yet. You know, it's think about like that sort of as opposed to vice versa, where you might be, already be an NFL fan, they're gonna watch Hard Knocks or whatever. But it's like, is that okay to have those fans that? Or do you ultimately need them to want to engage live and watch the live races or follow along with who's going to win in Miami this week or whatever, or Monte Carlo? Like, how do you start to reconcile that? Or again, like, is it okay for those fans to just be fans of the TV show ultimately?
It's a weird way to go about this, but it's like you can't judge again on where these fans come from. And there's been a lot of situations, right? It's like if you are a fan of the TV show and if you just want to be a fan of the TV show, that's great. And you can go about doing your life, but and go about doing the work that you do. It becomes a bit of a different thing now because now that everyone is watching the show, there's a level of interest there of how can I get involved and how can I use this as a way to leverage my own thing. And just because this is the next hot topic and this is the next trending thing, and so I'm going to capitalize on it. And to be fair, there's going to be moments like that across many different sports and many different topics. One thing is going to be trending, and so people are going to capitalize on that, and that's natural. I don't know if there's a real answer there, because it's, again, I don't want to come from a place of judgment, and everyone comes from a different place, and I'm in a very small bubble of people where we work in it professionally, but at the same time we are in a way professional fans at the same time. Like we enjoy being in it, enjoy working in it, but at the same time, we want to see, our favorite drivers or watch the race and be excited by it. So it's like, who's the real fan, who's not? And I don't know where you go from there. It's okay. I'm trying to think back to any personal examples that I have, but I was a big fan of the Last Dance documentary. And I can't say I've watched every single season after that. I've kept up. I'm a Raptors fan naturally because I'm in Toronto. And sure, you might call me a bandwagon fan because I watched the Raptors win in 2019. But am I justified being a fan? Can I go to a match? Can I go to a game if I've only watched a couple seasons and I've only watched a couple games? Like, it's a tricky subject.
Oh, totally. It's the evolving nature of sports in general, too, where you have these global teams and global sports where someone might say, I'm a diehard Man City fan, and yet you may never see Man City play in person. And that's different than a fan who goes to every match and lives right near Etihad Stadium or whatever. And there's just the different levels of fandom, and they all are worthwhile and are valuable in some ways. And there's different ways to think about how you monetize those fans, how you engage those fans, and you even again different fans that might be more fans of the strategy of the sport versus the storytelling of the sport, and they're all there for a reason. And I guess the maybe the key, and to your point earlier around like driving that community, driving that word of mouth, how do you find some things that so that the fan who is really into the engineering side of whatever what Mercedes is doing or Red Bull can also find something to connect with for the fan who is just wants to see if Max and Checo are feuding over something or whatever. There could be those community connection points that make the fandom of one and the other intersect in some ways and make them even more powerful as a result.
Yeah, there's a lot of demographics, right? So that's the one thing is, a lot of my work is focused on like how these new sport tech companies are bridging that gap for sport organizations and bringing these intersection of so many fan bases together. and helping them understand, you know, this fan has this type of behavior, or this fan likes this. You know, it's they have two different interests, but it's all around the topic of F1 or motorsports. And so, because the fan base is now so large, there's so many different levels of interest and personalities and people that find certain things interesting and certain things they don't find interesting. So it's a unique challenge, that's for sure. And I'm sure, you know, the NBA and the NFL has have the same issues, and they're all tackling the main issue there of how do we keep these fans and attract more fans down the road.
Yeah, and as these sports grow, I think even back to when NASCAR was like the only show in town at one point during the early part of the pandemic, when they were one of the first sports to come back, and they had this opportunity to try these new technology things. But I say all that to sort of tee up, like, when a sport, whether it's like F1 and that seemingly overnight success or growth rather in the States, or again that time when NASCAR had kind of had the attention of the country on themselves during the pandemic. Do you see these cottage industries kind of start to emerge around these sports, or whether it's hey, now we have all these F1 fans, there's F1 interest. Now there's, various media outlets or podcasts or video outlets that can capitalize on that, or in the space that you like to play in today with technologies. Like, hey, we can look at how are different ways we can be capturing data from F1 races and packaging it and giving it back to fans or sports betting. So, like, what's been from your point of view and just experience in the space? How have you seen these sort of, again, to use this term, like, cottage industry start to develop as these sports emerge?
Interesting. Well, could you describe cottage industries a bit more? What is
Yeah, I mean, like now that there's interest in F1 in the States, like, we're going to start a media platform that where we have multiple podcasts talking about them, or we're going to do a live
gotcha.
all broadcast, or we're going to take some of this data that we're getting from the F1 races and we're going to package it so that now we can give you an analytics view of what's going on in the races, or we're going to start a website that has like these Moneyball statistics about sports, or maybe there's technologies that are going to leverage act help those partners activate in a more powerful way and track the logo exposures during a given race or whatever it might be. Like, all these different things
Yeah.
can grow up or emerge because they're connected to this growing entity.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the motorsports for a large part of time and F1 have kind of lived in its own little bubble for the most part. You know, they've operated in a very exclusive circle, and people couldn't necessarily go in if you didn't have the right connections. And through a lot of the content and media and the show, what it's done is basically democratize, not to the full extent, but it's just opened up the door a bit more. So, you know, once before there was maybe only two or three doors, now there's five doors to get into, and new ways to enter the sport. And it's made things a bit more easier, let's just say. It's still difficult, but it's more easier. So I encourage it, to be honest. It's why I think perhaps I've been able to also help and kickstart my agency is, you know, new people talking about it has new people talking about the sport and interest around it has opened up their eyes as to what other things are happening within the industry. You know, sure, I might not be a driver, I might not be an engineer or a mechanic, but how else can I be involved? And, you know, if there's interest around it, then there's a level of, okay, next, how can I make money out of it and capitalize from this as much as possible? So I encourage that part because there's a level of innovation and creativity that then comes to go that kind of forces the status quo and goes, we need to try and evolve and change this a bit more. So something tangible is an IndyCar, for example. So there's a woman named Crystal Smith. I think that's her last name. Sorry, Crystal, but if I haven't got it right. But she used to work in entertainment in Disney, and I don't know if she was a fan before or after. But regardless, I think she got hired by Arrow McLaren, the team, and to come in and do their social media. And I don't think that would have happened pre-Bernie or pre-DTS as much, because there would be a level of you need to have experience within the industry, or you need to be in Europe to be in this space. And I love seeing that aspect of being able to adapt your skills from a different industry and bring it into motorsport. And I love doing that even with my own work, is to understand how can I take things from music or creativity or, these big music artists and translate that to motorsport, and how can I apply that to my own work? And that to me is interesting, because if we continue doing the same thing over and over again, we're going to get the same results. And I prefer being different rather than better.
Yeah, I mean, you're starting to see that throughout sports, that sort of blurred line between sports and entertainment, and trying to really understand what's going to drive people's passions, what's going to drive their attention. I kind of want to really touch briefly, a couple more minutes left here with Neeropump saying we're really just leveraging all of his knowledge in the motorsports and beyond. When you look at what the opportunities are for innovation, both in the physical fan experience of going to a race, I think in some cases it's like premium hospitality. Let's get these, 25, 30, 50,000, $100,000 experiences that might price out the average fan who might take their kids to a race. And then also on the viewership side as well, like what can make it so that even if Max Verstappen's winning every race, that it's still entertaining to watch? Or like what does the best version of a broadcast look like for F1, for NASCAR or whatnot? So I guess very open-ended as far as the on-track experience and accessibility, as well as the, what the future of broadcast innovation could look like. What are you seeing? What are you hoping to see? And what should you be looking out for in the years to come?
Yeah, there's a lot of new companies that are emerging out of this, more in the tech space. So, this stat I think it probably applies to a lot of different companies and sports, and leagues, is 95% or 99% of people won't ever attend a race. I think that same stat can then be applied to many different sports, because a lot of people either might not have the money or the capability to go to a live event. So, there's a lot of companies out there that are helping change that. They're progressing forward, and many are trying to enter that space. From that standpoint, it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves, and how you can perhaps translate a live experience and bring that to somebody's home, rather than just having it on TV. Going back to maybe like usability and just user experience of entering a live event. If I compare my experience going to an NBA game versus going to an F1 race, those are very two different experiences. One, F1 is across a whole week of events. The NBA, I can just go in and out, and there's a level of ease of access that I just enjoy with that aspect. With an NBA game, with an F1 weekend, you have to spend the whole week, or there's different challenges to both of those. So from the fan experience side, I think that's interesting, and in how people are going to bring that live event experience back to the home. To your other point, which I forget, you mentioned more around
We were talking about accessibility and making the broadcast. I think
accessibility.
you're touching on a lot of things.
Yeah.
Also, just the fact that like you look at whatever the race walk, track walk, whatever it's called, before like the Miami Grand Prix, and you see it's just
Yeah.
tons of celebrities and people that that can afford to be there. And you think about like the average ticket price for the Las Vegas Grand Prix, which is like if you are an average American making whatever your income is, and with two kids, you can't afford to go to that. Like, and so you're almost. You want to make that money, but are you doing that at the expense of accessibility to, future fans?
Yeah, then no, that's very true. I mean, that's a very good point as well. I mean, that's what I think. Going back to how can you bring that live experience back home? Some companies, in terms of broadcasting wise, are trying to help improve that. So this is the official app or official company sponsored with F1 or works with F1, but it's called Multiviewer. I think it's just a volunteer run company, but you can basically download that app and have multiple different views of different camera angles and different drivers to see what's happening across the track in this little segment times and whatnot. So in terms of broadcast wise, I see companies like that, I guess, evolving and bringing that experience to a wider demographic of people. And if people want more detail on that, that's where they go find it, right? So I see more companies like that emerging down the road. It's just interesting, because it's going to be very dependent on how much F1 wants to collaborate and where their interests really lie. Are they interested in just cash is king, or are they really interested in, nurturing these fans over a long period of time? And a lot of that, lot of their decisions will be and will be based on that.
Yeah, it's tough. 'Cause I mean, to how you fell in love with the sport, how I enjoyed going through a NASCAR race, like that in-person experience is so transformative and life-changing, and it can make a fan for life. But at the same time, like most of the sports, most pro sports these days in general are a TV product first. And so it's how to maximize that live viewership and have that second screen development. And who knows, like I can imagine watching an F1 race in Apple Vision Pro, like that'd be freaking like amazing probably. And the of esports around as well, to see more drivers coming up through esports racing, and as they make their way to physical racing. Just a really fascinating thing to look at for sure. One more thing for you here before go ahead.
No, go ahead, go ahead, go ahead.
I would say one more thing before we get to the shareable stat. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about this, because we were talking a little bit offline before. So nowadays you do a lot of your work is ghostwriting, and we talked a little about generative AI and how some people are writing term papers just through Copilot or through ChatGPT. And there's a method to the madness, I guess, of leveraging these generative AI platforms to help with writing emails, writing copy, whatever it might be. And you can do it in a smart way. The smartest way is probably not to have it do all the work for you. But how do you, like, tell us how you use that, the idea of like really smart, sophisticated prompt engineering, and like what can our listeners take away from how they can use these platforms in an effective way?
Yeah, I mean, we can't deny the existence of AI. I mean, like if people and people using it, I full transparency, I use it quite often. You have to understand how to give it the right prompts and prompt engineering, as I'm sure many have said, and how to utilize it to your best capabilities. So, it's sped up a lot of my processes that would just take hours and hours to go create. So I use it in a way where I give it certain prompts to help me figure out frameworks or templatized methods and processes where I have to basically go and repeat a lot of different things. And so it's like a lot of mundane tasks. I'm like, okay, this can be done much more quickly if I use this right prompt in this right way. For people that are wanting to apply it, if you're just a beginner, which I don't think many are, especially if you're within the marketing space, or it's how can you looking at your like mundane tasks and things that you spend a lot of time on, and how can you build frameworks or systems around that to speed up a lot of those processes, because it's going to be around. A lot more people are going to be using it, so it's I found it's better to get used to it now rather than later.
Yeah, I mean, now just to go full circle with our interview today, I kind of want to go to ChatGPT, to Gemini, whatever your preferred one is, and put in like different personas of motorsports fans. Like I came in because I like fast cars. I went to a race and I fell in love with the automotive part of it. Versus I came in because I enjoy the Drive to Survive, and this is a little bit about me, and see like what do the content strategies look like if you ask it to come up with copy for social media co content or a social media content calendar. It'd be fascinating now to try to look at those differences.
It's just going to be interesting how many people. I mean, I'm sure there's people out there that are using it more extensively and not so much. And I think sometimes people are maybe a bit afraid to say, "Hey, I'm using it by the way," because they see it maybe as a form of cheating or as a way of not doing the work authentically. But yeah, I'm curious to hear what people have to say about how I end up using it or whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah, lots more to come for sure. Well, there we're gonna have
Yeah.
more fun with you. We have more to come with you in our pit stop segment. First episode of Shareable Stat coming up right now. Really good stuff. So interesting being able to pick apart all the stuff happening in the greater motorsport space and F1 and the growth of fandom, the growth of social and content, and Drive to Survive keeps on going strong. The ratings keep going up. And we'll see where it goes from here. As I said, depending on who listening to this, the Miami Grand Prix just happened not too long ago as Formula One continues to grow in the States. So more fun coming up with Nero in our quick hitting questions, but first this episode's shareable stat. This is a service that comes from a recent report put together by Core Software. They are, you know, one of the leading software companies that helps sports teams with sponsorship, management, measurement, all of the above. And with the shareable stat in this recent report looked at the percentage of sponsorship revenue, as among other things, that is responsible for revenue in the sports space when it comes to digital and social sponsorship. And if you were to guess, what percentage of sponsorship revenue is made up by social and digital assets and activations? Think about it. It is 10%, perhaps lower, perhaps higher than you would have thought. But what it means is there remains a lot of room for growth as these industries continue to evolve, as the old school ways of activating sponsors continues to grow and evolve as well. And we start to realize and are better able to articulate the value of social and digital, and making sure that every agreement, every partnership has some social and digital elements to it. It doesn't mean it's all sponsored content. It means, you know, looking at other platforms as well. It means getting really good at articulating the value and being able to tie it back to goals. It means also scrutinizing the existing asset mix and how you can add digital to make it a stronger activation and drive better ROI. We're also seeing, as you may have heard in my last episode talking to Dan Gadd, about the growth of people in the sponsorship space that are specializing in digital, being that liaison between the social and digital and content teams and the partnership activation and partnership marketing teams, making sure that we are telling that story better, that it's aligning with what's happening on the social and digital and content side of the house, and making sure that we're getting better at telling those stories to the potential partners, to the prospects, to the existing partners as well. And again, we're just getting better and better every day at articulating the value of digital and social and creating more ways to activate, creating more ways to engage with fans and to integrate partners in a clever and effective way. So super interesting shareable stat. Again, the percentage of sponsorship revenue in sports that it comes from digital and social is 10%. And look for that number to maybe change in the years to come. But more importantly, stick around because more fun coming up with Nirupam Singh talking about motorsports and more with me. Right back with this episode of Shareable Stat, and I'm joined once again by Niru Singh. He is just a wealth of knowledge, as you heard in our interview. Niru, you kicked ass. Are you now ready to make some pit stops?
Let's I'm do ready it. For the rapid fire.
All right. First off, you have the skill set of a talented, experienced motorsports competitor. You get to drive in one race. What are you driving in and which competition? So you are a superstar motorsports driver. So you're not like inexperienced. You're not going to crash or anything. You get one race that you get to drive in. What's that? What are you driving in and which competition? What series and which competition?
You know, I was looking at this question before, and I had two answers, and I'm going to give you both, because one, obviously, it was so natural for me to say F1, mm-hmm. and I think that's an expected answer. F1 drive the W11, which is Lewis Hamilton's car, in I think 2021 or 2020. 2020.
Is there just, a certain location?
Just absolutely really dominant.
Certain track you have your eyes on too.
Yeah, Portugal, Portimão track. It's very uphill and up and downhill, very fast flowing corners. I would love to drive that track. Oh, yeah. In that specific car. And that was the obvious answer, but the not obvious answer would be the Isle of Man TT race in Wales.
Yeah.
And be basically Guy Martin, because I think those guys are, I think there's something loose in their head, because I don't know how they do it. And if I was able to say, you know, I'm not going to crash, which is quite rare in that race, and say, you know, I can drive this track and ride this bike around the Isle of Man TT track and not crash, I think that's a success on its own, no matter what the time is. And so I would love to say, you know, I've done that and conquered that.
Hell yeah. I mean, just the mental fortitude to go through something like that, knowing that you there's a high likelihood you're going to crash. That's got to be a yeah. tough one for sure.
Yeah.
Number two, we didn't get into this in an interview. I almost asked this question, so I'm glad I didn't. We saved it for this. Max Verstappen seemingly wins every race and almost always does win every race. Is his dominance good for the sport, or is there a potential risk of him decreasing tune-in for F1 races?
This is going to be a slightly diplomatic answer, because I think if people know who I am, they know I'm a Lewis Hamilton fan, and I'm not going to shy away from that. But at the same time, Lewis has also had his era of dominance, and there was a level of people getting bored by his domination as well. Obviously not on my side because I'm getting biased, and I'm sure now, if Max fans are seeing him win, they're gonna be like, yes, amazing. I do see his dominance is probably a bit higher than what Lewis is, because you kind of just expect it at this point. And I don't know if it's good or bad. I guess it leans more towards bad. Again, people are going to call me out on my bias, but I think we've had this shift in different generations and different eras of people dominating. Lot of people have put up in interviews and being like, I'm getting bored of this. I'm not going to watch. And it's going to ebb and flow. Yeah, we have new regulations coming in 2026. Hopefully things close up by 2025 when people understand that their cars a lot more. So I'm not really answering your question, but I guess it leans more towards bad.
Well, there's a lot of variables at play there. I mean, in some ways, like if people might tune to see if is he going to lose that? Is going to be the time that he loses? And every sport kind of needs like a quote unquote like a villain almost. But at the same time, there is that point where like, why am I going to bother watching this weekend? It's just going to be how much who comes in second place pretty much. It's definitely
Yeah.
there's no right or wrong answer there, but it's an interesting topic for sure. Number three, before you tell me, you've talked a little bit about this. You've had a roundabout career journey, now starting your own agency. What's been the most important lesson you've learned so far, whether it's throughout your just professional journey?
It's the act of specificity. So I've applied this rule of one across everything I do, and I try to implement it every single day, is to focus on if my entire agency was kicked off to the fact of being very specific and not being broad. So the rule of one was around, I'm solving a specific problem for one specific person. So I look at one specific person, one problem, and one solution, and that's it. And that has accelerated a lot of my growth to one, stand out, and two, be very clear to people on what I do. And there's confusion on that aspect, and that's what has kickstarted a lot of my work.
I like that. No, it's good introspection to really understand what you're doing, and be able to pick that lane and own it. All right, next question for you, Nero. I'm interested in this one for sure. I don't even know how to pronounce this all that correctly. You went to University with Wilfrid Laurier. Maybe is there a French like Laurier, Laurier?
Yeah, you got it.
All right, nice. So you went to that university. Tell us what should we know about it? Whether it's a fun fact, what the reputation is, what do we what should we know about the university?
Well, I think it's pretty commonly known about its reputation. It's known as a party school or party university, and if anyone's come out there during St. Patty's Day, you definitely know of the street Ezra Avenue. So that gets filled up very, very quickly. I don't know if it's the same as when I used to go, but it's definitely known as that place of like Ezra Avenue.
I like it. Yeah, we have our share of party schools out here in the States too, but that sounds like a good time for sure.
Yeah.
You had fun while you were studying, I guess, as well. All right,
Exactly.
next one. I've been really impressed and have continued to follow you on LinkedIn, where you've really become a great presence out there, just with great content and getting a lot of like the like top influencer type rankings as well. But it's well deserved. So tell me, I guess, your number one tip for someone who's looking to enhance their presence on LinkedIn.
Yeah, it goes back to that same approach when I of that important lesson is that rule of one. We have a lot of there's a lot of generalists. That's what a lot of I found I was able to stand out because I was able to be very specific with who I target and who I help. And because of that reason, more people know me of this of that in that space of okay, he does email marketing within motorsport. Got it.
Yeah. Do you buy or sell on sort of the collaborative articles that LinkedIn's really trying to push a lot?
I don't really buy it. Just it's funny. So many times it's prompted me on. You should talk about this collaborative article. You should talk about this collaborative article. I don't really know what they're doing with it. So I just tend to avoid it. It's best.
Well, yeah, speaking of rule one too, it's like sometimes they'll like prompt me to contribute to an article and be like, I this is not in my wheelhouse at all. Like, what do you like? You don't even
Yeah.
know what I'm here. What I'm all about. It's just, yeah, it's something to watch, but maybe it's some tweaks need to be made.
Exactly.
All right, next question for you. This would be a fun one. Tell me the most memorable race you've been at in real life, and also the most memorable race that you've watched on TV.
Well, the most memorable race I watched on TV was Abu Dhabi 2021, and I think I've just sent shrieks down people's spines and tingles down people's spines because everyone knows what that race was, especially if they know I'm a Lewis Hamilton fan. So that race was definitely
Oh, yeah.
memorable. The one a live race I watched was Bahrain 2004. I mean, my very first experience watching that race. I mean, I haven't. You can't replicate a V10 race with V10 engines, and watching Michael Schumacher go past. I mean, that's going to stick with you forever. So, that's definitely memorable.
What is the level of accessibility like for an F1 race? And I've been to NASCAR, and luckily, the times I have been to NASCAR, I've had a hot pass. So I've been able to get down there really close, and you can really feel it and you can hear it. Whereas if you're in the stands, and you only see those cars go by once every minute and a half or whatever, it's a different experience. What's the average experience like in an F1 race? And is there a lot of disparity between whether you have a premium pass or not?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's a massive difference about how big your wallet is and how much you're willing to fork out to have that experience. So fortunately, I haven't had to have that many experiences like that. I mean, I probably have a different viewpoint on it because I've worked in it. So it's, I have a different viewpoint of, oh, a fan experience must be nice. But the one time I did get to be a fan was at the Bahrain Grand Prix in 2021. 2020. So that put a perspective on, okay, how's it like to just be a normal fan walking around the space? And I could definitely feel like there was a major gap in that. But I had my enjoyable experiences with that as well. You had one-off chances to be like, oh, you see a driver, and there's unique moments in that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something we talked about a little bit during the interview portion as well. So a
Yeah.
lot there. All right, number seven, this should be a fun one. Tell me the most worst athlete or team, so athlete or team with the best content that you've noticed and why. And you're not allowed to pick anyone you've worked for. So
No. Luckily, my work with F1 was more with a different contractor, not with a team. I would say Aston Martin, and I've mentioned them already, but Jimmy's life. I know this is before the shout out, but A Jimmy's life on Instagram and TikTok. He does all their stuff for Aston Martin and for Fernando Alonso. And you can see through their TikTok partnership that Fernando just gets it, and Jimmy gets it as well. So they do things differently.
hell yeah, that's a great call out. I can't wait to go and check it out in more detail as well. All right, it's time for our food question here. We always get asked a food question, and we love food on this podcast. So tell me, if I go and we hang out in the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, tell me the best meal to get and where are we going?
We are going to Soul Shakers. It's a Mexican and Korean fusion spot on
Ooh.
Bloor Street, and it's fantastic. And the music is even better. So,
Yeah, what should we order? What's on your plate?
I mean, they have a set menu all the time, and it's kind of similar. But there's a small cheese melt thing that they have. I'm forgetting the name of it. I mean, I've been there so many times, I'm forgetting the name, but their entire menu is great. And they have I think, six or seven items on the menu. But everything's great on there.
Oh yeah, I mean, Mexican Korean fusion. Yeah, you had my interest already. So
Yeah.
we're there. We're going. All right, tell me your dream car to drive in on a race course, and your dream car to own for everybody to use. I think we might already know your dream car from an earlier question, for a race course, but so it was different. Tell us, but also your dream car to if you were just to actually own one to drive around town.
I might have a just as a because an F1 car is different to just a normal supercar. So I would say a Ferrari F12, B12, around a specific track. probably Spa, Belgium. I think that's a or Silverstone. You know, one of those two would be great tracks to drive on. The F12 is just a beast to tame. So I think I would love to drive that.
And how about one to drive around town? What's an actual like get around town car that's also awesome to own?
Getting around town, a higher version of this because we I own this. It's a Golf R to VW Golf R. I think it's just perfect. Such a nice little hatchback. You can just chuck it around town, and it's small, it's compact, and you can just go wherever you want to, and the right amount of power.
Not bad. I mean, maybe we need to get Volkswagen to create an F1 team one of these days.
Yeah, hopefully.
The last one for you, although I probably already know the answer, so we might just give you a second place one as well. The GOAT motorsports athlete is who?
Max Verstappen. No, I'm kidding. I mean, I'm gonna say Lewis Hamilton. It's very obvious. But you said the second. I don't like when people say an answer like Ayrton Senna, especially if they haven't grown up around watching him race. But I'm sure he was a goat, and he's fantastic. I can't give you a second. I don't know what a second is. There's only one.
How many more championships would Max have to win till he passes Lewis Hamilton in terms of legacy?
I mean, by numbers wise, you can pass him through
Just the
beating
numbers.
to getting to nine championships and winning over 103, 104 wins. And sure, you will get goat status then. But you know, in my eyes, it's a lot more just about the stats with Lewis. It's more about the culture and the way I grew up watching him. It was something about him when he was in, started racing in 2006, and when I started watching him in 2006, that made me just go, I like him. He speaks my language. I understand him. I'm going to follow him.
Yeah, and the way he transcended the sport and became a cultural icon, I think that comes into a lot of it too. I mean, it's not always just a pure stats question. It's who had the most impact, which is super interesting.
Exactly. That's yeah. Going back full circle to our first question about impact. He's created the most impact for me, so I continue to follow him.
There we go. I love it. Perfect place to end us there. But now it's your chance to take over the podcast and tell us your social media all-star to follow. Tell us who they are, what platform or platforms they're on, and why they're following.
Oh, this is a tough question. I should have picked out a couple because there's a lot more. Social media all start to follow. I think I wish I could emulate a percent of his humor and his charisma. Is a guy named Karl Shakur on Instagram. If you type in KARL underscore Shakur, he'll pop up and he's just a breath of fresh air on the app, and just someone who I can see I would just get along with and I would be friends with, even if we didn't talk about Instagram and whatnot. I think he just emulates a great type of energy. Just specifically around social, that's who he is. But I mean, there's lots of other like personalities that I just love that would also come under that realm.
Nice. Good call out. It's something someone will definitely have to check out. And then how about you? Where can we find you as well as your agency across digital social media? Where do you want to send us?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn all the time. You can see me posting there every day.
Highly recommend a
Most
follow and definitely give them a follow on LinkedIn.
appreciate that. It's my work is around email marketing and e email marketing for tech agencies, for techs, sport tech companies and motorsport brands. So I'm mostly around that and kind of speaking around my journey of how I started and how that's happening. So you can follow me on there, but I also have a newsletter called the Motorsport ANR, where I discuss, the future trends of motorsport and how they're impacting the current generation. And that's something I'm quite passionate about expanding more into. And so that comes out every Tuesday. So you can follow those two specific links and I can lead you there, and hopefully you find those two things interesting.
Hell yeah. Love it. You shared a lot of knowledge today. If you enjoy listening to Nir, you will enjoy the following on LinkedIn and his newsletter. Cannot thank you enough for coming on and sharing your time and knowledge and this awesome stuff today, man.
Really appreciate the time, Neil. Thank you for setting this up. And yeah, like you mentioned, it was a great conversation and it flowed very naturally. So hopefully I can recommend you to more motorsport people to come on, because I think this is a very interesting topic.
Awesome, super interesting, fascinating conversation with Neeru Singh, talking about his work in, doing ghostwriting, doing strategy in the greater sports and tech space, especially motorsports. Check out his newsletter as well, as we mentioned there at the end, Motorsport A&R. Follow him on LinkedIn, where you can see lots of his good content and insights every single week, every single day. Just really interesting stuff, and it'll be interesting to see where this F1 continues to go. Some people might say it's starting to hit a plateau. Some people may say it still has lots of room to grow as more people pick it up on it, and there's more accessibility to the sport, both the digital, social, and television content, as well as just going to the events itself. So lots more to come, but I really thank Neeru for coming on the podcast today and lending us some of his insight, knowledge, and wisdom. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for listening. As always, I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. Hit me up on Twitter, NGH287. Also on LinkedIn, where I post more content. Visit the website, dsmsports.net. Visit my other website, this new platform that we're trying to get off the ground, slyke.co, S-L-Y-K-E. I would love for you to contribute to it, and hit me up if you do visit. But more importantly, come back for the next episode, because we'll be here for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.